This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
So let's go straight to the first caller, Zach. Zach in Greenwich. Hello, Zach.
You all right, Nick? How you doing?
I'm all right, how are you?
I'm okay. My question is, considering that the narrative coming from these jihadis, that they want a puritanical Islamic state and they want to live by the laws of the Sharia and whatnot, however warped they may be or whatever you may, like the West may think of that, do you really believe David Cameron, when he, in his narrative, when he says that they pose the biggest threat to the UK on UK soil?
I'm afraid, and yesterday we met in the National Security Council for the umpteenth time to look at that. That's the sort of group that gets together in Whitehall to look at this. Prime Minister's the chairman of that. I'm the vice chair, and I'm afraid it appears to be a fact that the flow of people leaving the UK, going to Syria, for instance, becoming ever more radicalised and extreme in their views, but also, of course, becoming ever more expert in the use of violence, and then wanting to come back to inflict that violence on our streets, is now one of the biggest security challenges we face. And that's why, you know, that's why we've been pretty open as a government, saying, look, this is a big issue. It's right up there at the top of the security agenda of the things that we're looking at government, and we're doing everything we can to either discourage people from going there in the first place, or of course making sure we keep an eye on them if they come back with violent intentions. You know, it's one of the, I'm afraid, it's one of the oldest things that violence begets violence, and that appears to be the case, and that's why this bloody, barbaric, brutal civil war in Syria is not only so tragic for the Syrian people, it's dangerous for the rest of us as well.
Zach, go ahead.
It seems like to me that it's a similar narrative to what Tony Blair said about Iraq when he invaded Iraq. Tony Blair, he said last week about it wasn't, it's the lack of intervention in Syria that has caused this to happen. However, the way I see it is that if the UK was to intervene in Syria, and it's a good thing that they didn't intervene in Syria, who would they be fighting? Would they be fighting the Assad regime, or would they be fighting ISIS? It makes no sense what he said, and I just think the man's delusional.
Well, I mean, what you think about Blair, or indeed what I think about Blair, is slightly different to your first question. Blair, as you know, Blair and Bush claimed at the time that we needed to invade Iraq in order to prevent the use of weapons of mass destruction. It was a completely different claim he made at the time, one which, by the way, unlike Conservative and the Labour parties, my party opposed. We said very clearly, no, that is not a good enough reason. You haven't proved your case. I also happen to remain personally of the view that it was not a legally sound decision either. You're asking me a slightly different question, which is having people go from our country to a war zone, becoming ever more angry and extreme in their views and ever more practiced at using violence, is that a threat to us? Yes, self-evidently it is. Do I think the solution for that is that we should invade Iraq? Of course not. We're not going to take military action ourselves as a country in Iraq. But that's not to say it is not a threat. It's not to say that we shouldn't work with other countries in order to deal with that through counter-terrorism measures, through intelligence, obviously working with the Iraqi government where we can, in order to make sure that there is a semblance of stability in that country. But so I actually agree with you that kind of just going around invading every country where you think there's a problem is not necessarily the solution, though I have to say I think on Syria there was a case to deal with the weapons of mass chemical weapons, which were which was the debate at the time. But I think we can't put our head in the sand. This is a real problem.
Deputy Prime Minister, what are we to take from Tony Blair popping up over the last few days and saying that, in fact, it was justified and that it was right he did what he did in Iraq, and it's important that we took the action we did?
Well, my view, listening to him, is that, I mean, there's one thing where I actually think he's got a point, which is what Zach and I have just discussed, which is that the violence in Syria is acting as a sort of generator for violence elsewhere. And it has a spillover effect to other countries. You know, we shouldn't pretend that kind of bloody civil war just is sort of hermetically sealed within the borders of Syria. I mean, that, you know, I think he's on that, he's self-evidently right. Where I think he's just plain wrong is to somehow suggest, which he sought to, which I thought was a rather contorted argument, that says what is happening in Iraq now would have happened even if we haven't invaded Iraq. And as if somehow the invasion of Iraq, which I thought was the most disastrous foreign policy decision that this country has ever participated in since the Suez Crisis, somehow disconnected with what happens 11 years later.
So the Arab Spring would not have sprung in Baghdad.
Look, I personally am not going to spend a huge amount of time trying to reinvent history and say if this hadn't happened, would that have happened? Yeah. And I don't think, and I think it's a slightly pointless thing for Tony Blair to have done. But on Syria, I think he and most people, and in a sense it's stating, I believe, the obvious, which is that kind of bloody civil war, you know, going on with such ferocity over such a prolonged period of time, of course it has an effect on people who move in and out of Syria, but also on neighbouring countries.
The Prime Minister, lastly on this before we move on to the next call, the Prime Minister, there's approximately 400 British-born national
that insurgents. That we know of.
Can we not strip them of their citizenship? Do we have to let them back in, Mr. Clegg?
There are a number of things we can do and that we do and Theresa May and the Home Office do seek to block people from travelling or block people from returning. So there are a number of things we're doing. We're also...
But can Britain actually take your citizenship away?
There are measures that we can take. We're also strengthening the measures we can take by making it an offence to participate in the planning of any terrorist activities elsewhere, outside the United Kingdom. So we're going to change the law. We're going to do that in the coming weeks and months to sort of fill what we think is a gap in the law there. So there are a lot of things we can do, but you know, we live in a free society. People do move around. We don't have the thought police. You can't check what every person's intention is. This is a fluid situation, and I think it's right that we say, without causing undue alarm, that we're nonetheless fairly straight with people that this is a serious issue which we're treating very seriously.
Yes.
And no one should be under illusions about what is at stake.
And so some people could. You could foresee a situation in which a leading terrorist would actually have his British citizenship taken away.
As I say, we can take people's passports away if we think that their intention
is to...
And you
could see that.
It happens already. So there are measures that can already take... Right. The Home Office already does those things within the powers that we've got. As I say, the one area where we think there is a case for additional legislative powers, we're moving to take on those.
Let's get other callers involved.
David in Enfield. Hello, David.
Good morning, Nick.
Morning.
Good morning, Mr. Clegg. My question regards China. Why is your government punishing Russia for annexing Ukraine, but rewarding China for doing the same to Tibet? And I say this because in 1959, the Dalai Lama, with over 100,000 Buddhist supporters, was forced into exile. And under Chinese occupation, there's been the systematic destruction of Tibet's culture and religion. Over 6,000 monasteries have been closed. There's been widespread detention without trial, torture, killings, and other abuse of human rights, similar to China itself. And millions of Chinese have been forcibly resettled in Tibet. So 6 million Tibetans are now a minority in their own country and treated as second-class citizens.
David, look, ever since I wrote a read, not wrote, read as a young boy, that book by is it Heinrich Harrer, the 7 Years in Tibet?
Yeah.
I've been, like many, many people, acutely aware of the unique religious and cultural identity of Tibet. I met the Dalai Lama on a few occasions in his capacity as a religious leader, but as you know, we recognise that Tibet is part of China. But notwithstanding that recognition, of course, we believe, I passionately believe, that we should be firm, polite, but nonetheless forthright when we speak to the Chinese government in saying, look, the human rights abuses that are occurring in Tibet, or indeed in other parts of China, are simply not compatible with the status that China is seeking on the international stage. It doesn't mean we can't trade with China. In my own view, in the long run, more trade with China actually will bring in its wake political and social reform as well. But you're quite right in saying that, yes, Tibet is recognised by Great Britain as part of China, but that does not mean we should shirk from saying, look, whether it's in Tibet or indeed in any other part of China or in any other part of the world, if you believe that human rights are indivisible and universal, then you've got to have the courage to be able to say so, even when it is uncomfortable or inconvenient to do so. And that is what I do. That is what we do as a government. We seek to strike the right balance, do it, as I say, in a respectful but firm way, and that includes the human rights abuses that appear to be continuing in Tibet.
Quick response from you, David.
I'm not satisfied at all with that answer, because my question was, Russia invades and annexes Crimea, and you punish them. China invades and annexes Tibet.
I know you're going to disagree, David. But David, so the difference is, I know you don't like it, but it's just a fact. The difference is Britain has long recognised Tibet as part of China. We don't recognise Crimea as part of Russia. It's just a difference. I know you don't like it, but that is, and by the way, that is not a distinction drawn by this government. That has been established some time ago. I know that's not going to satisfy you, but that is the way that Great Britain has responded over many years. All I'm saying to you is that doesn't mean, notwithstanding those differences, that we can't be firm and forthright about the human rights abuses that still continue on a significant scale in parts of China.
This is Nick Ferrari with more to come as I look back at my week on Breakfast. This is LBC. This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on Breakfast here on LBC.
Kay in Wood Green. Kay?
Hi, good morning.
Hello.
Hi, this is a call regarding the longer days for school children.
Right.
Or working class. I was just wondering, it's a two-part question, basically. How is it going to work? Will the white working class children be segregated from their peers to carry this out? So what will happen to other low-achieving minorities who are also in the class?
Yes.
And the second part, I'd like you to explain how the statistics seem to show that young black boys are attaining higher educationally than white working class boys, yet they remain the highest unemployed group in London, with over 50% unemployed.
Okay, just to explain to some listeners, this came out in some research earlier this week. The percentage of students getting A star through C grades is now among white working class boys and girls is the lowest. It's less than half, for instance, what Chinese girls attain. There was an initiative suggesting there should be extra hours put on the curriculum for all children, but specifically for white boys and girls, because they're the ones that are failing, and children would actually, in some instances, stay at school for the best part of about 10 or 11 hours. And the other point, Kay, you're driving at, is that how come the black boys are doing much better in school, but then when it comes to employment, they're still falling behind what would appear to be poorly educated white boys who actually get the jobs.
Mm. Well, okay, I mean, you are putting under the spotlight probably the biggest failing in the school system in this country for many, many years, which is what they call in the jargon the attainment gap. So how is it that I remember reading some research which had made a huge impression on me some years ago, showing that bright but poor kids invariably, not always, but very often get overtaken in the classroom by a less bright but more affluent child by about the age of 7. Very early on. Very, very early on. The early years in primary school. And that after that, often, the gap continues to widen. In other words, how you do in school is more closely associated with the income of your parents than your natural gifts.
So should you stay in school longer if you're poorer, financially poorer?
So what do you do about it? Now, what I think we've got to do about it, and that's exactly what we are doing about it, I first wrote about this 10, 11 years ago, and finally we're actually delivering this in government, is you've got to put more money, more resources behind the education of the children who deserve and need most of the help. And that's what we're doing through this thing, Kay, called the pupil premium. It's £2.5 billion of extra money which goes to those schools which are catering to the kids from the poorest backgrounds. And that allows the teachers, and here's the important practical point, Kay, it allows the teachers then to decide how and when they give extra one-to-one tuition, maybe even Saturday morning catch-up classes. Some of that pupil premium money, for instance, is being used, I think, to very good effect, to make sure that kids, as they make the leap from primary school to secondary school, have got some support in the summer holiday to do so. Because time and time again, we find that it's the kids from the poorest families who find that leap from the sort of small, sheltered primary school to the bigger, sort of slightly rougher atmosphere of a secondary school hardest to take. So we're putting in the extra resources so the extra hours, the extra tuition, the extra support can be delivered. And I'll be fairly shortly awarding some prizes to the schools that have shown how best to use that extra money, that pupil premium money. It can have a brilliant effect at closing the attainment gap.
Including longer hours?
It can do. If what you think is right for a child is to spend a bit of extra time, either before school or after school, or even maybe on a Saturday morning, particularly doing intensive work on numeracy and literacy and the other basic skills that you need to get a good education, often in small groups or one-to-one, that, you know, then teachers should be allowed to do that. But, Kay, you know, we're not going to turn this around overnight, but I think we're finally starting to put into place the measures needed to make sure that the education does what it says on the tin. It releases the potential that is in every child, regardless of the circumstances of their birth.
And, Kay, just to clarify, it would never, ever be white-only classes. It would be children who are not performing well, and it just so happens in a lot of they happen to be white, but if there were Chinese girls who weren't performing well, then they would be included. Just to nail that, Kay, thank you very much indeed. Guest, another email. Dan in Dartford. Nick Clegg, why are you still opposing Nick Dubois' idea to give mandatory jail terms to anyone who's carried a knife twice?
Sorry, who was it? Was it Dan, was it?
Dan in Dartford.
Yeah, Dan, but look, I'm as intolerant and as tough as anybody else on knife crime, but I just want solutions that work. They don't just sound tough, catch headlines, but don't actually catch the kind of criminals and turn their life around.
What won't work about this seems to make sense to me. It does it on the tin or whatever that expression is.
Well, I don't think it does. What it will end up doing is you'll end up going to jail. Let me be very clear. A young person, let's say, who's in a gang and is forced by a bigger, sort of more senior member of their gang to carry a penknife for them, right? If they're caught and charges are brought, then there is no discretion to chuck them into prison for several months. The evidence is overwhelming. If you put young people into prison, regardless of any individual circumstances, any mitigating circumstances, into prison, guess what happens? You turn today's young offenders into tomorrow's hardened criminals. And I'm proud of the fact that we've brought crime down to the lowest levels on record under this government. I'm proud of the fact we're starting to bring reoffending down. I'm proud of the fact that we've got lower numbers of young people in prison. I think this measure, it sounds tough. You will tell me you think it's great, Nick Ferrari.
No,
I don't think it'll work in practice.
How many?
You asked for an answer. Stop interrupting me.
One of your shorter ones. And how many children are appearing in courts in England, Wales and Scotland because they were carrying penknives?
I don't have the statistics on the top
of my head. Well, there are none, are they, Mr.
Clegg? No, wait a minute. There's a principle at stake. It says this measure, which has been supported by Labour...
Do you honestly think they would drag children into courts for carrying a penknife?
Look at what the law will now say if this measure is finally passed in Parliament. It says to judges, you have to imprison someone just for possessing a knife, having had a previous offence, regardless of any individual circumstances. And all I'm saying is, if you really want to be tough on knife crime, do what works. Don't just do the things that sort of catch headlines. Listen, I lived through the Blair years where we saw literally week after week after week, one tough-sounding measure after the next. I think there were 25 criminal justice measures. And actually, why I'm so disappointed with the Conservatives is that when we came together in the coalition, I remember vividly we said, you know, there's one thing we can really unite about is let's not resort to all these populist gimmicks on crime, which actually just lead to higher rates of repeat crime. And we've stuck to that. That's how we brought crime down. I think it's a pity that a few months before the general election, the Conservatives are once again resorting to the bad old Blairite habits of talking tough on crime rather than really doing what works.
Let's fit in one last question if we can, Deputy Prime Minister.
Jim in Pimlico. Hello, Jim.
Oh, good morning, Nick. I have a brief request for you. I'm requesting you to contact the Foreign Secretary and ask him to ask the Swedish police to come and question Julian Assange at the Ecuadorian embassy or via video link. This would save taxpayers an awful lot of money and free up the police to deal with more important matters.
Today it's second year since Mr. Assange sought sanctuary at the embassy. The policing bill, Deputy Prime Minister, is at £6.5 million.
Yeah, look, I understand people's frustration about this sort of mounting bill that's landing on our lap when Julian Assange, if I understand it correctly, for perfectly obvious reasons, should be facing justice in his own home country.
He's frightened he'll be abducted or somehow swept off to the US.
Well, look, Sweden is not a banana republic. I mean, Sweden, as far as I can make out, is a pretty civilised country with a pretty sophisticated justice system, and I'm assuming they will give him a fair trial in line with Swedish law.
What about the idea of a video link or something like that?
Jim, I have no idea whether that would work. I'm not a Swedish prosecutor, but I do accept that the best thing would be for Julian Assange to to basically put his put himself into the hands of the Swedish judicial system, not into the hands, if you like, of the British police, and footed by the bill of which is footed by the British taxpayers.
We end on a lighter note. There's been some heavy subjects. I don't know what the Spanish for anger or bad temper is.
Don't.
In
look,
your
pictures,
house,
pictures on the television of the new king.
Indeed. Well, we say congratulations. We say that, of course, in Spanish. How was the
Felicidades.
Felicidades.
Okay. Say that again, Nick.
Felicidades.
Very good.
How was the Sea Clegg household last night with
bit
the Spanish?
Bit glum.
Dear, oh dear.
But as my 10-year-old, it just shows the great maturity of my children. He was rather sort of quiet last night. But then this morning he said, very philosophically, I suppose that's what makes World Cup so interesting. Isn't he wise?
He's a politician.
Well ahead of his years.
And just looking ahead to tonight, you got the score right last week. You may recall when I asked you.
I predict a 2-1 victory for England. How about that? Slightly the wrong way around there.
Yeah, so you got the score right.
Slightly the wrong way around.
So can we now get Mystic Clegg on what we will see tonight? Mystic Clegg, that's quite clever.
Okay, 1-0 to England.
1-0
I think it's going to be really tightly fought, but I think we're going to...
Okay.
We're going to pick
and the whole
post.
House now switches to England, of course.
Of course.
Yeah, full square.
As if there was any doubt.
Nick Clegg, thank you. This is Nick Ferrari. More highlights of my week on breakfast after the news. This is LBC. This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC. Parents should be fined if they miss parents' evenings, fail to read with their children, or allow homework to go undone. So says Sir Michael Wilshaw, the Chief Inspector of Schools, who's of course going to be with us later this month. Sir Michael Wilshaw, yes indeed. Do you want to give me the date? A week tomorrow, Sir Michael Wilshaw will be with us taking your calls, the Chief Inspector of Schools. Meanwhile, yesterday he said teachers must confront bad parents who do not support their children's education, and he accused white working class families of no longer valuing education as a way to improve their family's prospects. Put the date in your diary, a week tomorrow, Sir Michael Wilshaw. Let me run through those comments again. Teachers must confront bad parents. Parents should be fined if they miss parents' evening. Fined if they fail to read with their children. Fined if they allow homework to go undone. And white working-class families no longer value education. Sir Michael goes on in an interview with The Times. Children with immigrant parents outperform poor white British children in the classroom. Many hold a deep cultural belief in the importance of doing well. It's interesting, isn't it? Too often, deprivation is used as an excuse for low achievement. Drawing on his own experience as a head teacher at inner London schools, and I should tell you, in education circles, he is an acclaimed head teacher. You might not like what he's hearing, but he is perceived as being a very successful head teacher in his day. I was absolutely clear with parents, says Sir Michael. If they weren't doing a good job, I would tell them so. It's up to head teachers to say quite clearly, you're a poor parent. He goes on, if parents didn't come into school, didn't come into parents' evening, didn't read with their children, didn't ensure they did their homework, I would tell them they were bad parents. I think head teachers should have the power to fine them. It's sending the message that you are responsible for your children, no matter how poor you are. Lastly, he criticised TV shows such as Shameless, a Channel 4 show set on a housing estate in Manchester featuring a feckless family that he says celebrated bad parenting. Quotes, it's almost glorifying fecklessness. Well, it's a real attack on the poor white working class. How fair is that? How fair is it that I'm sure if you miss one parents' evening, I don't think for a second Sir Michael Wilshaw is saying them, but if you never go to parents' night, good idea. Let's fine you. If you do allow, you never assist your child in reading. I don't quite know how we'd ever prove it, but again, good idea. Let's fine you. I agree with that. If you miss out on helping them regularly so that they go home without their without their homework, again, good idea. Fine them. But what say you? Frances Gilbert is a teacher and author of Working the System, How to Get the Very Best State Education for Your Child. Where do you stand on this, Frances Gilbert?
I suppose I feel quite ambivalent. Listening to what you're saying sort of makes sense. I think that the trouble is that if you land up being overly punitive with some of these parents, and I've talked, you know, children of these sorts of parents before, you can get in a really negative cycle because, you know, and they land up beating up their kid and shouting at them and, you know, doing all the sorts of wrong things. Really, the parents need to be educated.
It's interesting that, use the word cycle, actually, Mr. Gilbert, because if you don't step in and take action, are you not, and it was the word I was going to use, actually, are you not perhaps fearful that the cycle will continue? Bad parents breed bad children who breed more bad children, and on it goes.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that. I think that's absolutely right. But it's a question of how do you actually deal with the problem. And if you land up, you know, fining some of these parents, they land up taking it out on the kid and being really unpleasant to the child. And then it just, it makes things worse. And actually what you really need to do is you need to get a positive relationship going with the parent and get
Mr. Gilbert, I admire you for what you do and the fact that you've been a teacher, but I would imagine that's impossible in some instances. Dad's not there, mum's a drunk. How am I going to build a positive relationship with her?
Well, because by getting medical help, and in fact, I have taught a parent who was, an alcoholic who did need help, you know, and I think that, you know, you need, if you have case conferences with these sorts of difficult parents, and I've sat in quite a few of them where, you know, you have a social worker there, you have the different teachers, you have the a responsible adult and sometimes a parent, and you work out how you're actually going to sort the situation out. But I guess just finding the parent who often may well be in debt may make things worse. I don't know. I mean, you know, I don't think there's any easy answer. You know, I have quite a lot of sympathy with what Wilshire is saying because, you know, it is frustrating with certain parents who just, as it were, just stick two fingers up at you and just say, you know, I'm not going to do it.
When he was when he was at his inner London schools, he said if parents didn't come into school, didn't come to parents' evening, didn't read with their children, didn't ensure they did their homework, I would tell them they were bad parents. Would you do the same?
I would avoid using really negative language like that. I think it can really backfire. And I have done that. I've been teaching 25 years, and I have said it to parents, and that all I get is a stream of abuse back, and it hasn't worked, you know. Because these parents get very defensive, possibly if you're a head teacher with, you know, the sorts of authority that he's got, you know, people bow down. But I'm just an ordinary, you know, foot soldier teacher, and the parent just says F off to you because, you know, who are you to say that? And you have to find kind of, you have to find, you know, and what they say is they say things like, oh, I remember one kid I told, you know, it wasn't good enough. He said, oh, I'll put him in the bath. I'll put a whole load of bricks on him and I'll turn the cold water on and then he'll behave himself. And you think, well, that's the last time I'm going to tell the parent anything about what the child's doing in school because, you know, it's torture, isn't it?
Well, it is by another name. Absolutely, sort of thing they do in Guantanamo Bay. Francis Gilbert, teacher and author of Working the System, How to Get the Very Best State Education for Your Child. Thank you. Sue Wilkinson is CEO of the Reading Agency. Would you be supportive of the idea of parents being fined?
No, I wouldn't. I don't want anyone to see reading as a punishment. I want them to understand about the pleasure that comes from it and how it can bind you together as a family.
I put you the same scenario. There is no dad. Mum is a drunk. The child isn't reading. What are you going to do?
We do a lot of work with schools and with public libraries. So what we would be saying to the head teacher and to all the teachers is tell your children about the summer reading challenge.
They don't
talk
care.
Talk to your local library.
They don't care. The child has got no, it doesn't, is unfortunately quite backward in reading. There's no point telling him or her about the summer reading project. They can't read. And mum's always drunk.
Well, in fact, what we've seen is that children can become passionate advocates for reading. Schools do encourage children to do things for the library. The libraries are very proactive at reaching out to children and getting them involved in something like the Summer Reading Challenge. And then what happens is the children are doing what they need to do. You're not going to solve the problem. The mother's still drunk if you're punishing her or punishing the child. And if you're trying to fine her, then the child is going to get punished for it. So I don't see that as a solution.
Sue Wilkinson, thank you. You're CEO of the Reading Agency. To fine or not to fine those errant parents. You're a bad parent, and I'm going to fine you. It'd be interesting, wouldn't it? LBC reporter Tom Swarbrick has been speaking to parents on the school run this morning to get their reactions to Sir Michael's suggestion about the fining.
getting tough on bad education, getting tough on the causes of bad education. Almost seems like a criminal offence now to not read to your children, given the way Sir Michael Wilshaw talks about it, Nick. This is what parents said about their childhood experiences of reading.
All sorts of books, really, to about to the age of about 6 or 7.
Yeah. And you think it benefited you?
Yeah, I do.
And did your parents make a special effort to do that? Were they conscious of the fact that they need to sit you down and read to you?
I think when they had time.
Do you think, though, that reading to your children is beneficial for them?
Yeah.
Do you agree with that? Yeah, yeah. Definitely. Do you make a special effort to do it?
Yes. Yeah. We read to them every night. It's part of his routine. It helps him know that it's bedtime. So, yeah.
You can measure the success of an upbringing a million ways. Just because a parent didn't read to their child doesn't mean they failed it in the slightest, no.
When you have children, you told me you don't have children earlier, but when you do have children, will you read to them? Will you make a conscious effort to?
Absolutely, absolutely. My girlfriend, she is very, very bright, and I know she was reading at a very, very young age. Oh, really? So as you can see, I'm dressed to go to work as a builder. So, yeah. And she's a doctor. So maybe we can measure the success of reading at a young age by that. So yeah.
But he's a very good builder. Quote, if parents love their children, they should support them at school, says Sir Michael. Effectively, if you allow them to play truant, you don't love them. He's not sitting on the fence, is he?
Tom Swarbrick reporting there from the school gates. Tom, thank you. Poppy's in Reading. Poppy, should parents be fined?
I don't think it wouldn't have made no difference to my mum. She was on heroin, like, all the time I was at school. Then I got took into care, so she wouldn't have. She had more important things to think about, like her need was more important and addiction was more important. And then when I got took into care, my life was too chaotic. It wouldn't have made no difference to my mum. Not at all, nothing.
How old were you when you realised your mother was on heroin?
About like 5, 6 years old. But I knew she was sick at 5, 6 years old. And I got took into care in and out and went home again and... Then I kind of knew by about 8, and by 13 I had it all. My life was mapped out. By 13 I was like, okay, I'll give up on my mum. Like, this is what I'm going to do myself. So I sorted it out myself. Like now, I'm passionate about books now, right. And I've learned Arabic, and I've got a language, and, you know. And by the way you pronounce his Ahmed is wrong. You says Ahmed, and it's not, it's Ahmed.
I'm grateful
it's like with
to
a Ahmed.
Poppy, I'm very grateful to you. I shall think of you every time I pronounce that name. How difficult is it growing up with a mother who's hooked on heroin?
Oh, that's a stupid question.
Why?
Like, how difficult do you think it is?
I don't know. I've not endured it. That's why I'm asking you to share the experience.
Well, put your imagination there. How difficult do you think it is?
I would have thought it's impossible.
With a mum on... Huh?
I would have thought it was nigh on impossible.
Exactly. But then the state, like, steps in and puts you into, like, care and stuff. And that's good, like, being cared for and all that stuff. But it's chaotic. There's no getting around it. You've got no space to do homework or nothing. And all you're thinking about is who's going to nick my stuff and who's going to, like, smack me up when I get home. Like, if I've gone into their space and whatnot, you can't think about homework or nothing or academic stuff until... people solve them problems, which are screaming at you loud. You can't be educated. The only time that I could be educated myself, like I'm 20 years old now, is when I left school.
This is Nick Ferrari with more to come as I look back at my week on breakfast. This is LBC. This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
I would have thought still extraordinarily high. It's 1 in 8 women. I'm so sorry. 1 in 8 women still smoke during pregnancy. Now, it says here, despite strong health guidance urging women to quit. Strong? What more could we have done other than go around with hose pipes and actually extinguish the cigarettes the minute the girl lights it up? God, everybody on the planet must know. Despite strong health guidance, it says here, 12% of mothers-to-be in England class themselves as smokers last year. Now, the figures have dropped to an 8-year low, which is something we must, of course, applaud, but they're saying still more needs to be done. There's a whole slew of numbers here, 75,900 expected mothers out of 632. We won't go on about it too much. There's some interesting statistics, geographical breakdown. For instance, such as Blackpool, more than 1 in 4 mums-to-be smoke. 1 in 4. Meanwhile, in parts of London, in Richmond, it's under 2%. So it's quite a national discrepancy. Look, I won't shout at you if you're a woman and you smoked during pregnancy. I promise I won't smoke. And you'll probably be able to say, oh, look, I only had five a day and my baby came out. Absolutely fine, honestly. £9, 50, 14 ounces and captain of the rugby team. I was just a girl. You can tell me what you like, but it would seem at best inadvisable, wouldn't it? Let's speak with Professor Robert West, who's Director of Tobacco Research at the University College London. He's an author as well of the Smoke-Free Formula. Professor, it would seem to me, what they call in the States, a no-brainer. Do you have any idea why women still do it?
Well, quite a good idea, actually, and I think probably most of your listeners do as well. One thing we do know is that they don't do it because they want to. If you look at whether people, and you may see, you may say, well, they would say that, wouldn't they? But our experience is that the vast majority of women, when they get pregnant, make every attempt. They really have a good go at stopping. And the problem, of course, is that nicotine is an addictive drug when given through cigarettes, and some of them find it very hard. And just to give you an idea as to, why we think that. If you look at, you mentioned yourself that the rates are very much higher in the north, and they're very much higher among younger smokers, and they're very much higher among people with social disadvantage, and they're very much higher among people who take in more nicotine from their cigarettes. Now, there's nothing particularly different about people in the north versus the south in terms of their sort of moral virtues, but what we have is a situation where a whole range of things are conspiring against them. And so, I completely take your point about, that it seems reprehensible. But I think, if I may say so, a more appropriate response is to say that actually we as a society have a responsibility to do everything we possibly can to help them to stop, and we're not doing it.
So what more should we be doing, or what, in practical terms, what should we be doing? Yeah.
Well, one of the things is to make sure that we actually know, really know, who's smoking at the start of the pregnancy. So, for example, when the woman comes to the doctor or the midwife and they're asked about their smoking, and, of course, they're not necessarily going to tell the truth because they're embarrassed and they feel stigmatized. So one of the things that we need to do is just to do a very, very simple breath test, carbon monoxide breath test, which tells us whether they're smoking or not. And it's not a sort of punitive thing, but it's just like you do any other sort of diagnostic test, so that if someone is smoking, then you can help them to do something about it. Excuse me.
No, not at all, don't worry. Do you think, then, what percentage of the mums, if they had the proper help and support, what percentage would actually, do you think, be able to stop?
I think it would be a quarter of what it currently is. So if it's currently, the official figures are 12%, of course, as you can imagine, they're almost certainly quite a bit higher than that, because that relies on self-report. But let's say 12%. I reckon, you'd be down to sort of 3 or 4%. And the reason I say that sounds, very optimistic. But we know that if people do engage with the support of the kind that the NHS does provide and can provide, if they really engage with it, it makes a massive difference. Another thing, actually, I think it's really worth saying is a lot of women think, well, I smoked in the first month or first 3 months, and therefore really the damage is done and it's too late. But that's definitely not true. Most of the harm is actually done in the last 3 months of the pregnancy. And any day that you don't smoke as a pregnant woman is actually beneficial to the baby. So, even if you can't stop completely or for the whole time, anything that you can do is definitely a plus.
And lastly, in brief and perhaps rather layman's terms, what is happening to the baby? Is it oxygen starvation, isn't it?
No, actually, not really. Sorry.
No, don't worry. As you can see, I'm not a medical man.
So it's a range of things. As you know, there's something in the region of 4,000 toxic chemicals in the tar from cigarette smoke. There is carbon monoxide, which would ordinarily, it does deprive the body of oxygen, but actually what happens is that the body produces more red blood cells to compensate. Now, it's a whole range of the whole range of toxins that you get in the tar, which effectively they change the growth process and they change the way that the cells divide. to sort of undermine all those biological processes that are going on.
Thank you for that. That's Professor Robert West, Director of Tobacco Research at University College London, author of The Smoke-Free Formula. Let's hear now from Chris Snowden, who's from the Institute of Economic Affairs and author of Velvet Glove, Iron Fist, A History of Anti-Smoking.
Well, I would, you know, don't do it. It's a very bad thing to do. Yeah, but there are also lots of other things that are bad during pregnancy as well. Drinking. And drinking is, in a way, the opposite of smoking, in that it's actually worse if you do it early on in the pregnancy.
Yes.
I agree it's going down. It's good that they're lower than usual. Something always needs to be banning. That would be a problem.
Indeed. Is it a mother's choice?
It's a choice they should be free to have, I suppose. It's just a very inadvisable one.
So is it the role of government just to continue to advise, or should there perhaps be a bit more stick?
Impractical. And if you're going to start acting using the law in that way, then would you also do it with drinking? That was suggested, actually, last year. I can't remember who it was, but some medical group did suggest we should ban women from drinking during pregnancy. And indeed, there's a case, I think, is still going through court, in which a woman who had a baby with fetal alcohol syndrome is being prosecuted. Now, again, obviously nobody wants to endorse heavy drinking during pregnancy, but should it be a crime?
Chris Snowden, you're from the Institute of Economic Affairs. You're author of Velvet Glove, Iron Fist, A History of Anti-Smoking. So, ladies, or indeed the husbands, the fathers, the partners, can you say, we smoked through pregnancy and we did just fine?
Hi, Nick. Hi. First-time caller.
How lovely to have you. How long have you been listening to this radio show?
Probably about a year or 2 years. Me and my husband both listen to you every day in the morning.
Do you want to say hello to your husband? What's his name?
Yeah. Hi, Mario. How are you doing?
Hey, Mario. What's Mario do for a living?
He's a warehouseman.
Good on you.
In Peckham.
Is he on his way to work now?
No, he's listening to the radio now, I believe.
Oh, he's listening now. Well, you've just said hi to him. Now, what are you going to tell me? You've had a baby or you're having a baby? What's the story?
I'm currently 17 weeks pregnant, so expecting a baby at the end of November.
Oh, fantastic. So you're going to be fairly big through this summer then, young Renner?
Yes.
Is it your first child?
Yes, it is, yes.
Okay.
And we actually planned to have a baby.
Right.
We started trying at the beginning of the year.
Oh.
But I also coincided it
I think
with,
you've been rehearsing prior to that as well for a few times.
Yeah.
I thought you might have done. Well,
we also decided to, both of us actually gave up smoking around the same time as sort of trying for a baby.
Yeah.
I was really pleased that my husband decided to give up as well. Because it is hard to do, I'm not going to lie.
Yes.
But, you know, because we had the foresight that we was actually going to start trying for a baby, we thought, well, there's no point in sort of dragging it out any longer, and we don't want to be smoking when we have got children around, because ultimately, you know, kids sometimes do take on what their parents do as well, but I felt it was really important, especially for myself, smoking.
Yeah.
And I managed to do it. I've been smoking since I was 15 years old.
I'm Nick Ferrari. You've been listening to the highlights of my week at breakfast on LBC. I'm back on Monday leading Britain's conversation with the big breaking stories of the day, along with regular travel updates. Have a great weekend and stay safe. This is LBC.